welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about the more recent Netflix show Barbarians, or it's about pirates, or it is about the concept of the barbarian, or it's about the late antique period, or it is about me talking about my master's thesis, i.e. it is about anything we feel like talking about on any given day. My name's Phoebe Roy. I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, Pat Wyman. How's it going?
It's going fantastic. I love when we have a show that doesn't suck that we can use as an anchor to discuss lots of interesting things. And I think through really nothing intentional, like I don't feel like we can take any actual credit for this. We happen to be watching a show that does not suck.
I know. It's so exciting. It's so exciting to watch something which doesn't suck. But it does. I don't know. I'm kind of nostalgic for the days of those about to die.
See, you say that, and yet you forget the mind-numbing sensation of banging your brain pan against.
I mean, it's true. It's true. However, one thing I would say in its defense is that this show that we are watching, Barbarians, we are watching season 1, episode 4 today. Milo is off in Australia. I mean, we haven't heard from him for a few days, so we don't know what's going on.
I'm assuming eaten by a saltwater crocodile whilst looking for a pack of Marlboros.
Option one. That's potentially true.
Crushed under a deluge of Gold Coast OnlyFans models.
Option two. Option three. Tragically died in a 24-hour gooning incident.
That, okay, but most likely, yes. That's of our three options.
Or he's decided to move to Australia and start the first jokes about tractors only comedy club in Melbourne.
Yep. I could see him getting involved in large scale sheep farming in the outback.
Yep, large scale sheep farming. That's what Milo's up to so far as we know. Like I said, we've not heard from him.
Literally, any of these could be happening. It's Schrodinger's Milo right now.
That's right. The comedy club is going to be called That Tracks.
I heard that in his voice when you said that. I 100% heard that. That tracks. Oh my god. I feel like on his international adventures, he is very much a man of mystery. I don't know what he's doing. You don't know what he's doing. None of us really know what he's doing. We assume there's comedy involved.
We assume it's something. I figure it's something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Every so often, I wake up to a voice note from him, and I'm like, This could be something about work. This could be something kind of like really practical. This could be something about arrangements for George and I's upcoming wedding. It could be any of those, or it could be a bit of gossip. It could be a bit of like, guess what just happened at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. It could be just the weirdest bit of extracts from his romantic life. We just don't know. We simply don't know. We cannot guess. And this is one of the many joys of being friends and colleagues with Milo Edwards. Milo, feel free to cut all that if you would like.
Or leave it in. You know, I suppose it really depends on your comfort level with the exposure of such secrets about you.
Yeah. You could do some choice beeping. They're called the Milosinian Mysteries, and it's something to do with life after death. We don't know.
Yeah, they jealously guard those secrets.
They do. The Order of the Milos jealously guard his various secrets.
I'm just imagining like a subterranean Mithras temple, but devoted to Milo. Like, what would be in Milo's subterranean temple?
A tastefully muted pastel t-shirt.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
One MILF.
Yeah, singular.
Potentially a vape.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the time of year. A pair of corded BMW specific driving gloves.
Sure. Yeah. That's
it. That's all. That's it. It's just a big cavernous room with a really highly polished black marble floor. You know, the kind that you kind of look in and mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. see your reflection, and it feels like you're kind of looking into the river at the end of the world, like that kind of highly polished marble. Just that, and then the different objects of Milo devotion arranged on plinths.
I kind of wonder if that's what ancient temples actually were, and archaeologists have just been wrong every time we've excavated one. Like, really, this is just a spot where 3rd century AD Milo kept his driving gloves. Like,
yeah, exactly. His chariot gloves.
Yeah, we've made a huge category error in our understanding of the material remains of Roman civilization.
What's that called, the thing that you put on your forearms?
Like a bracer?
No.
I know what you're talking about. Why can I not think of the term for this? I used to think they were cool as hell because in The Mummy, Brendan Fraser's character wears some. And I remember thinking that if only I could do that, then maybe I, as a 14-year-old, might also have sex someday. it turned out to be wrong on all fronts. But that was the dream. All thanks to the leather things.
Are they called like greaves?
I gotta be honest. I don't know what they're called. I think bracers is what they're usually called, like in a video game when you have different pieces of armor and they're like, what kind of bracers do you have?
Yeah.
But that's all I can think of. I know there's another term for them. I know you're right. I just don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, if we need to come back to this, we'll come back to this. But I also really like the idea that whenever there's been a kind of archaeological dig, looking at a temple, the idea that where everything is sort of just a guess. Like, it makes mm-hmm. sense for the altar to be there. It makes sense for the colonnade to be here. It makes sense for any kind of sacrifice or anything like that. If that just goes on here. I mean, like the temple building, as we all know, as we all know, if we can all remember back to our classrooms, the only thing that a temple actually requires is an altar. In order for a temple to be a legitimately religious building, it just needs an altar. You can have an altar in the open air. A temple or a Greek temple, what you're thinking of when you hear ancient temple, they were treasuries. They were treasury buildings with an associated temple. The temple is not the building. It's a kind of synecdochal arrangement. But I love the idea that we've just got it completely wrong. And actually, there was this massive building, and everything was just crammed in one corner. It wasn't kind of beautifully, kind of neatly, like arrayed on the ground at all. It's just like everything. We got the statues, and we've got the tributes, and we've got the altar. That's all there in one corner, and then everything else is just like I don't know.
So a swing ball court. It's funny when you say that because in the rare occasions when we actually do discover kind of an in situ building, like a building that has just collapsed and been abandoned, like something that burned down, right, with all the stuff inside, it often turns out that there is just shit everywhere. Like, the ancient people were not any necessarily less messy than we are. Like, you might have caught them on a bad day and the house happened to burn down and it's just like nobody's taken out the washing. There's just a pile of trash in the corner. Somebody's left a half digested meal sitting out. Like, and this often happens when you discover like a hastily abandoned archaeological site. There will just be shit everywhere.
Yeah. It's super interesting. I love the idea that it's just like the ancient people were just as repulsive as we are.
Sometimes worse. Like if you excavate a village, oftentimes you will just find rubbish pits like right outside the front door of a house.
They were just perched amongst the refuse, just chilling out.
Yeah, this is often true. I think it's especially true in like early Neolithic villages where people are kind of living together for the first time in large numbers. They're sedentary, and these places are just disease factories. And like there is quite often a huge drop off in population after the early Neolithic. So people start coming together to live in these villages, and they bring all of these domesticated animals with them, and they're living close together. And it's just they just have managed to create a new disease ecology, and they have no understanding of sanitation because they've never had to live together in these numbers before. So like there's a site called Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which is one of the first kind of big occupied for a long time Neolithic villages. It's almost a city. Like at one point, there are probably a few thousand people living there. And this is like 7,000-8,000 years ago. So this is very, very early. But over time, you can look at the skeletons of the people who live there and they get less healthy. Like you can see infant mortality rises, maternal mortality rises, the average age at death drops. Like you can tell that over generations of living in this place, just surrounded by the shit and refuse of past generations, that it is making them ill. And so I think a lot of ancient history is like that, that you just go to a place and you're like, God, this is gross.
My God, right? Disgusting.
Like, why wouldn't you throw out that half of the pig when you were done with it? Why is it just sitting there? Like, I think that's kind of a thing that happens more often than we might expect in the past. God. Just gross. Just disgusting. Just disgusting.
What do you think would happen to the health of a population over the years if they weren't allowed any media other than Amazon Prime's Those About to Die?
Well, nothing good, I can tell you that much.
Crumbling skeletons.
Yeah, well, it's
covered in sores.
It's just like, I'm trying to imagine like a large language model, like some AI program that's trained solely on Those About to Die, and that is very close to my personal conception of hell.
Very small brains.
Yes, extraordinarily. Okay,
just
so
like thickened skulls with tiny little gap in the middle for the tiny brain.
I do love a thick skull. I have a friend whose taste in men, as he describes it, is men with a brow ridge, or men who look like they might hit me but won't. And this is and what you're describing right there is the physiognomy of that man. Like that's sure. the average inhabitant of these villages. There was something I don't want to lose that you mentioned earlier about religion, because I think it's relevant to today's episode in a few different ways. And it's something that really stood out to me, that there is a sensitivity with which this show deals with ancient religion. And a kind of a nuance to how they think about it that I find really appealing and really reflective of the time. Because at a basic level, we know far less than we would prefer to about ancient Germanic religion. We really have very little understanding of what their religious practices were, of what their beliefs were, of the way that religion kind of fit into society more broadly. We make inferences on the basis of burial practice, on the basis of references that we have in written texts. We have some ideas based on much later sources. So even going as far forward as kind of Icelandic sagas for the conception of the pantheon of available deities that were there. So we have kind of this vague idea, but our sense of the actual lived experience of the ideas that Germanic speaking people had in the first century AD about their relationship to the gods, how the gods interacted with the world, very, very limited. And so in this show, they've taken the few legitimate clues that we have, and they've built on them in what seemed to me to be really plausible and creative ways to give us this whole worldview that is not our own and also not the Romans' worldview. And it's not just an inverse reflection of our understanding of Roman religion. Like these people are their own thing. They have their own ideas about how the world works, and that gets them to act in ways that are meaningful. I found that really fucking compelling as I was watching this episode.
Yeah. Something that I've got a note about this here. Something that I thought was super interesting about it is that when Ferquin and Thusnelda are trying to get the one of the other tribes to kind of join up with them, their belief in their gods is used as like as an axis of mocking. They use it mm-hmm. to make fun of them, and that's something which would have been, which is not, it's, I suppose it's not a specifically alien to a kind of contemporary audience, but it would have been utterly alien to a Roman audience who really did take a, as long as you pay your taxes, we don't care what you do. Mm-hmm. If you start fucking around with your taxes, then we're gonna have a problem. And this is the big issue with the discussion of religious toleration and religious persecution in the Roman Empire, because most of our information about religious persecution comes from religious sources. So you have your church. So you have your church fathers talking about the kind of the mass persecution of the Christians, and obviously that's the lens through which they're going to see it. That's the lens that makes the most sense to them. And if you are a true believer as an early church father, you're not going to say, well, no. This was clearly like a kind of series of political persecutions as much as anything else. It wasn't ideological, and it wasn't anything to do with a kind of objection to the religious practice. Of course it wasn't, because of course they're not going to see it like that. But it does mean that the way that we understand what a religious persecution might have looked like is very, very skewed and very seen through this kind of particular lens. You can't really call something an active ideological persecution of Christians until really, really quite late.
Diocletian, basically.
Yeah,
is...
it's not until Diocletian. And I mean, I think the evidence that his objection was to the idea of monotheism is pretty shaky. Again, I think it counts more as a political persecution. I mean, obviously, say you're a Christian of the period, I suspect the difference to you would be somewhat academic. However, there's this idea, for example, that Nero persecuted the Christians, and it's just not right. So I think it's interesting in a show like this one, and I think it's potentially interesting in terms of what the cultural and academic background that we're working with here, because Germany is not like the UK and it's not like America. It's got a very, very specific and discrete history of the study of religion, thinking about religion, philology of religion, and it is a history which is significantly interrupted and cut into by the history of German fascism.
Yep.
And the history of German Lutheranism.
Yep.
As it happens, and how German fascism found its kind of natural roots in German Lutheranism. Like without Martin Luther, there could have been no Nazis. It's a real big domino, little domino situation that they've got going on there. And I think it's really important to remember that the history of German scholarship, particularly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, this is who was interested in ancient religion and ancient philology and ancient myth and all of its superstructures and how cults operated and who was following them and where they came from and what kind of cultural exchanges were happening. No one was interested in Britain. It was all just, well, pagans, and then we had Christianity. That's the big changeover. Somebody, God, as is my understanding, turned a big key, and then Jesus also had a key, and they both turned them at the same time.
Much like a nuclear football.
Much like a nuclear football, and then boom, we had the big changeover. All the clocks went.
Like a really fucked up daylight savings
that's
time.
That's how it worked. Really mm-hmm. fucked up daylight savings time. We have a big dial that goes a ka-tunk, clunk. And that's what happened. But German scholarship was far more interested in, well, what are these people up to? What do they believe? What do they believe? What do they believe? Yeah. And if you have a TV show and understand the TV show as a text, and you are interested in making an accurate TV show, you have to think about what the cultural and intellectual context that comes together to form the TV show and to form the assumptions around the TV show. And actually, I'm going to talk about this up top before we get into the plot, because I suddenly remembered that I had some fun Arminius intelligence, which I didn't know about until I was reading up on it in preparation for the show, which we talked about at the end of the last episode with Milo. And I'm just going to go into it now. I'm just going to seamlessly segue into it now. And this is something that is super interesting. So Arminius became a really important figure historically in German nationalism. And he got given a new name. He got called Hermann. And this is who Arminius is. He is supposed to be a symbol of singular German nationalistic courage in the face of Roman imperialism. And so somewhat inevitably, very, very popular as a figure by German poets, playwrights, and scholars as well, as somebody to kind of invest with the historical culture of Germany and German symbolism, German nationalism. And then had a little bit of a wonky time with Hermann around the 1930s. I don't know, something occurred.
Something happened. Can't quite be sure what.
Something occurred, and Hermann became a real big, oh, we love Hermann. We love this guy. And many years ago, when I was studying for my master's, one of our tutors had this Nazi copy of Tacitus's Germania, which he brought in, and he passed it around. It had a dedication to Goebbels on the book plate and a big swastika in it. And he passes this book around, which is repulsive, but it's presumably worth quite a lot of money. I think it should be burned, but you know, that's my thinking. And it got passed around the room, but with basically no explanation and no context, he just showed up with it and was like, "Hey, have a look at this."
That's not the correct way to introduce that as an artifact.
Are you coming out as something here? Is this what's happening? And we passed it around the room in silence until the last person who got it looked at it and just said, "Why do you have this?"
What was the answer? I got to know what the answer was.
He said, "Don't worry about it."
No, now I'm very worried.
Now I'm very fucking worried about it.
I want to tangent real quick off of this. Sure. And then we'll come back to the core issue of German Romanticism and its roots. But I have been shocked over the past few months at how many people are just closet Nazi fans. Like they now appear to be coming out of the woodwork, given some shifts in global geopolitics that I don't think we necessarily need to go into here. Like, I thought that it was kind of incidental, or that it was like convergent evolution, that like if you just dehumanize people for long enough, you kind of end up in the same place as the Nazis ended up. But what I'm realizing now is that there are just way more people than I thought who actually just like the Nazis and think that they didn't really do anything wrong. That I had known that these people existed because I knew actual Aryan Brotherhood members when I worked construction. I had coworkers who were actual legitimate card carrying to the extent that you can be white supremacists.
They didn't give you a card, right?
They did not give me a card.
They didn't have like an actual, it wasn't like getting your thing stamped at at Costa.
Not quite. Like, not quite like that.
You don't have like a kind of Aryan Brotherhood loyalty card.
It's actually like a punch card.
Okay. Do you have a card with us? No, I actually left it at home. But you know what? If you log in, you can still get your points.
That's my understanding of the system that they work under. Like, I knew that these people existed. I knew that there were probably more of them than we figured. I didn't realize how many how many people would be open to those kinds of appeals today. I thought that kind of there would be some sort of lasting memory of Nazi crimes that would at least tamp that down. I was wrong about that. I think now all of a sudden we actually do have to make the argument in public that Nazis are bad and deserved to be punched, killed, defeated in battle. Like, I didn't think we had to have that conversation. Apparently now we do. That's very disappointing to me as both a historian and a human being.
I was at primary school, we had a head teacher who used the Nazis as an example of not being wrong, just having a different opinion.
No, don't like that.
And we all went, that's interesting.
Jesus, what is fucking happening?
He was a bit of an eccentric sort of guy. I mean, like, yeah, you know, you I mean, you're totally right. I mean, and also then you have like the clean Wehrmacht guys. They're sort of knocking around. You have the they were just as much victims as anyone else.
Those guys are my least favorite.
It wasn't their fault that they were Nazis, I guess. There's quite a lot of them. But I don't know. It's just whenever anyone is like, oh, yeah, like, he's big into World War II. Like, he's a big... He collects World War II memorabilia. It's always like, what kind of memorabilia, motherfucker? It's always the same.
Yeah.
It's always the same. So, yeah, no. I'm afraid I'm not as horrified by it as, in fact, you know what, like, quite recently I was rereading Slaughterhouse-5 because I was feeling to reread it, and there's a very bleak but probably very kind of necessary account of the bombing of Dresden contained within it. But there is also in Slaughterhouse-5, written by presumable non-Nazi Kurt Vonnegut, non-Nazi sympathizer Kurt Vonnegut, which approvingly cites David Irving, and says that David Irving writes about, you know, kind of the truth of the horror of the bombing of Dresden, which I don't argue with, I don't disregard this as an idea, but David Irving is using the bombing of Dresden in a very, very specific and very, very repulsive way. He's not doing it as a kind of this was a discrete atrocity which should be thought about in more detail. He is using it as a very specific and very, very ugly and very false, a verifiably false those argument. And I'd totally forgotten until I reread it that there's this positive citing of David Irving within this book. And again, like, Vonnegut was a writer, he was not a historian, but like, this stuff is, it's been around. I mean, even the fact that there was no consistent anti-Nazi activity after the war. I mean, like, I say, like, on a par with anti-communist activity, it wasn't even that there was a bit. I mean, in America, it was actively kind of, well, as long as you promise not to use some of your less fashionable language around the workplace, why don't you come live here? You can fold you in.
This is absolutely essential to understand. Like, that huge numbers of Americans prior to World War II had generally positive opinions of what Hitler was doing there. The United States and the UK as well. And the UK, yeah. And that those people's opinions didn't just go away completely because of World War II. They were those sentiments were always there waiting to be reactivated. But I want to come back to Herman real fast.
Yeah, yeah, sorry, I really feel like we could have this discussion forever. While it is interesting, it is not the subject that we are discussing today. We're heading really into like undergrad essay, like when you're doing an essay and you're like, there is no space to discuss here, and then you're just like, boom, yes, yep, no space to discuss here, that means I can pretend I've thought about it, but I haven't, because there's no space discuss here.
Yeah, this is the end of paragraph 3, and this is a 5-page essay. We are working under some limited constraints. Yeah,
as guess what? No space to discuss that here. But what is fun about Arminius, right? And this is something that I did not know. So after the end of the war, he got kind of sidelined, should we say, tucked away, very kind of like, no, never mind about, like, you know, the German scholarship and the kind of the pre-Nazi German intellectual and cultural tradition that was really interested in this story and this history and this figure. That was there. Okay, no, we're just gonna have to, you know what, no, delete it, we're gonna have to just delete it and start again, sorry lads, we're gonna have to do that differently. However, meanwhile, in East Germany, he was picked up again, he was picked up and revived and revitalized and reinvested with a new set of symbolism, which was the proto-figure for anti-imperialist German communism. So how about that?
So this is the truly fascinating thing, because you're 100% right. You can track developments in German intellectual culture just by looking at how the figure of Arminius has been treated, right? So if we go back to the beginning of the 19th century and the flowering of German Romanticism, which is in large part a reaction to Napoleon and the French imperial takeover of most of what had been the Holy Roman Empire, the modern German state system grows out of the post-Napoleon settlement of Germany after 1815. These things are not separable, right? So you have the specter of a Roman-identified empire that has just conquered your land, right? And you are looking for national heroes who can be kind of pan-German unifying figures in the 19th century. That's how we end up with Hermann the German, with Arminius as a key figure. And this fits really neatly with German Romanticism, which feeds directly into the racial ideologies of the 20th century, that you have this idea of a kind of a primordial people, in this case, Germans. We know that there was no cultural or political, much less political, unity to Germanic speaking peoples in the first century AD. We know this. We have tons of evidence to tell us that this is the case. But looking back on it from the Romantic perspective, there was always Germanness, and there were always people who embodied Germanness. And Arminius is your perfect guy to point to say that, like, we have that the German spirit is oriented toward freedom and resistance and blah, 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 blah. Like, whatever Germans thought positive character, like racial characteristics were in the 19th and 20th centuries, you could make Arminius kind of the bearer of those. You could make him the symbol or the seed.
Yeah. He was an endlessly useful figure until he wasn't. Although I still kind of like the idea of like Schiller or someone just being like, okay, we're going to call him Hermann. And like his editors being like, are we going to call him Hermann the German? Nope. We have a little question mark there, Schiller. And being like, yeah, we're calling him Hermann the German. Line is jerk store. We're calling him Hermann the German.
I'm sorry. That's a non-negotiable for me.
It's non-negotiable. I am out of this meeting if you don't let me call him Hermann the German.
Just storming out, throwing a sparkling water at the door. Like, that's, I don't. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because this is meaningful history in the recent sense. This is like these are not neutral figures. And to your point, I think it's interesting that this show gets made in the late 2010s, early 2020s, right? Mm. That so now Germany has been unified again for the past 30 something years. This is a moment in German society when there are really strong regional and ideological differences that are threatening to kind of rip Germany apart at the seams. And you have so in that moment, somebody makes a show about a figure with a history of pan-German unification. That's, I don't know what to make of that. And I don't know German politics, culture, society well enough to be able to locate it more precisely. But I will say at least that the juxtaposition is interesting.
It means something, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know what. I'm not that smart, but it means something.
It means something. It might mean something bad. It might mean something neutral. It might need something good. We don't know.
Well, I think we can say that they have taken a revisionist view on Arminius in this. And that they have treated him, the way they have set up this character, treats him like a real person who could have existed in this time and place, who's subject to competing loyalties, competing senses of identity. And that, from where I'm standing, as someone who's read a lot of this stuff and knows the archaeological material and knows this world reasonably well, I think people like that were fucking everywhere along the Roman frontiers. And it's really easy, to the point of the plot of episode 4, which revolves around Arminius being told that he's not going back to Rome, despite kind of completing the mission that he's been given. He is going to stay in Germania and he's going to be the king of the Cherusci. That this is not the life that he had wanted. He wanted to get out of there. He wanted to make his life elsewhere. And I think a lot of people who were born to those circumstances would have just completely assimilated. They would have been an army officer on the Sahara frontier who happened to have been born a German, but is in every way that you can tell a Roman, right? Yeah. Like, he's not speaking German when he's in the army camp. He's speaking Latin. He gets stationed on the Mesopotamian frontier. He gets stationed in Arabia. He gets stationed in somewhere along the Danube. Like, the fact that he is of German origin makes no difference whatsoever. He is culturally an elite Roman.
Yeah, I mean, like, my understanding is that there isn't really much in the way of hostility towards origins. What matters is whether or not you're a Roman. Like, I'm not aware of, like, for example, anyone using Trajan being Spanish as like a kind of, yeah, but you know, Spanish isn't even,
you can tell there are certain segments within Roman society that
see him with his tiny food. There's like miniature food that he eats at 10. He eats at 10 o'clock at night. You see him with his little instruments going clack a da clack clack clack. You see him fucking Trajan.
I do love the idea of there being like some old blue blooded patrician who's just like doing tapas based racism against Trajan. that's no way to do an appetizer.
His plates are too small. They're too small. Why has he got so much deep fried courgette in there? Why has he got the fried artichoke leaves? What are they? Why are they on the little plates?
I mean, I think in fairness, I'm probably reading in my own critiques of tapas, which is that they are too small.
What is patatas bravas? What makes them bravas?
I don't know, but I know that there should be more of them than there are. Like, I'm not a small plate kind of guy. I find the very concept offensive. And
I feel like that's the least surprising information I think I've ever been given.
Yeah. Oh, that I don't appreciate a small
that
portion
not,
size.
That you're not a small plates guy.
No. I want sizable plates. So maybe I should. So maybe what I'm saying is I should be more racist against Trajan. I guess that's the key takeaway there.
That's the takeaway.
You're pretty much right. There were some people within Roman society that were always going to look down on you for specific origins, whether those were kind of servile origins, whether you were you had been born a slave or were descended from a free or were descended from a freed person.
Yeah.
That. I think that dividing line is actually more important than ethnic origins.
But that's class.
Yeah. I think that's the whole thing is, if you're born to a good family in Germany, which our Arminius here is, right? He comes from a locally prominent family. If you adopt Roman manners, you're going to pretty much disappear into the mainstream of Roman provincial society.
Yeah.
There's just nothing separating these people materially, ideologically, maybe somewhere deep down in their hearts, they have some alternative or competing senses of identity. But from our perspective, looking at them 2000 years later, it is almost impossible to identify. Like a lot of the time you don't even know, because we have thousands upon thousands of inscriptions, often funerary inscriptions from around the Roman world, right? And you see this person who's presented in an entirely normal mainstream way. And then there's one note in their epitaph that's like, oh yeah, he was from Syria, or he was from Germania, or yeah, this person had been born a Mauritanian slave. And you're like, oh, but you never would have known that if that line hadn't been in there. There's nothing about this person's name, their description of them, any of that points in that direction.
Although, I mean, that shows how they're commemorated. It doesn't necessarily show how they were treated in life. I think what is interesting about that piece of like probable information compared with how he is portrayed as a TV character is that actually his origins are super important, not because of where his loyalties are eventually going to lie, but in terms of how Varys treats him, because what is suggested here is that he, as far as he was concerned, he's always been Varys's Roman son. He's always been his large Latin boy.
Yeah, his very special lad.
His very special poor. Mm-hmm. He's the special little poor. He's the poor Reno. Yeah. That's right. He's the poor Reno. I can't remember what the masculine diminutive is. That's why.
I know because it
would be Purella if it was girl, but like obviously that's not.
Yeah, I was gonna say like puericulus.
Yeah, puericus. I was his fancy little birthday puericus.
I was gonna say like puericus, and then I realized puericus. That would be like conqueror of boys, and I'm like, that means something very different.
That's
in the Roman
different context.
puericulus. Yeah, he was supposed to be Varys' special little guy, and now
special little guy.
But he's just a tool.
He's gonna get him a special hat on his birthday.
We just got deep into Arminius's peccadilloes.
Arminius's psychological landscape there.
That's a mess. Oof.
But he was using him as a tool all along to implant him as a tame chieftain, which is something that we talked about the last time you and I discussed this episode, which is a way that you, if you really just don't have like that many people in a kind of centralized way, how do you maintain this gigantic multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multi-person empire? You have to have your tame local guys. You have to have your special little birthday boys, your special little frontier birthday boys. At each frontier, we've got one little guy, and he's got the crown. He's got the paper crown.
Yeah, this is the essence of how the Romans managed their frontiers, especially at this stage when we're still pretty early on. The frontiers get a little harder the later we go as we get into the second and third centuries. But especially at this point in time, Rome does not have defined frontiers. It doesn't have a specific line where you say this is where the Roman Empire ends and this is and on the other side is something else. What you have is kind of a gradation of Roman influence and power that is you got to imagine Roman power like pouring water onto a topographical map. Right. Yeah. And it's just going to kind of flow down through the peaks and valleys and rivers in specific ways. There are going to be some areas that it more or less avoids. There are going to be some areas where it runs very strongly. But you can't pour the water onto a flat floodplain and expect to get coverage. That's not really how this works. You have to have channels through which your power can run and function. And those channels are people. They are people like Arminius, who have been put in power with Roman help, who are indebted to Rome, and who can ride herd on those lower down the social spectrum in their social groups.
Yeah. And then you got people going on like the gap, going on the gap year to say Syria. And they're just like, look, I'm in Rome. Now I'm not. Now I am. I'm just hopping from foot to foot. Rome, Syria. And that's what happens. Then you got like kind of, you know, British classes, like classicists in the 18th century, just being like looking at the maps and just being like, no, we want to draw the line. We want to draw the line on the map. We want to draw the line on the map. We need to know where the flags go. Line. This is how I imagine things. So that's what Varus has been setting Arminius up as all along. And Arminius is like, but I thought I was your boy. I thought I was your guy. I thought I was your boy. I thought I was truly your son. And the implication being, I thought to you that I was truly Roman because I was your adopted son and I was truly your Roman son. But you think of me as like your barbarian ward, like you're like, I'll still just be a barbarian to you. And what I'm wondering is whether that would have been a meaningful distinction or whether this is just a bit of character drawing color that the makers of the show have put in to make what Arminius does more understandable.
That is a fascinating question, and I think if we're trying to look at the actual historical examples that this would be speaking to, you're probably going to get a little bit of both. I mean, because it's easy to see plenty of scenarios in which Varus takes these two hostages, raises them, but then the circumstances in Germania change such that they're no longer politically useful in that role. Right. And in that sense, they just become a Roman cavalry officer or a prefect or whatever. And they and these are the people who kind of disappear into the mainstream of Roman society that when it's not politically useful anymore, then, yeah, he really just is Varus's formerly German adopted son. But in these cases where the political circumstances haven't changed and where that person is still politically useful to Rome, then you end up with this tension because it struck me. And I think this is good characterization of Varus. It makes him more than kind of a one note villain. Is I think Varus wants Arminius to be happy. I think he wants him to be a good Roman. I think he wants he likes and respects him. He thinks that this is a guy who has a lot to offer to Rome and to him personally, and that there is an emotional bond between them. Mm. But for Varus, with his conception of what Rome is and how it's supposed to function and what his job is, like, say what you will about the Roman elite, and you can say a lot of bad things, but they really did have a pretty profound sense of duty and responsibility that was always leavened by self-interest, right? Like, they're always looking out for their own ambitions, but there is a really truly deep-seated sense of responsibility to the res publica and to this kind of common shared project that goes back generations, that your ancestors have contributed to, that you're bound to. So for Varus, there's never a conflict in his mind between sending Arminius to do the job that he has been prepared for and his love for him as an adoptive father. Being an adoptive father means that you put your children in the position where they can do their duty and fulfill their responsibilities. And
that makes a lot of sense. It kind of feels like the medieval nobility sending their kids off to foreign courts to get married when they're like little kids. It's not like a sign of never thinking that they were really their kid. It's just what you did.
Yeah. It is a necessary expectation for that time and place. But what I really like about this and why I think this shows that this show is doing something really interesting is that it allows those different things to coexist. Mm. That these characters are multidimensional. They have more than one thing going on at once. They're not driven solely by one motivation, by one need, one desire. They have multiple kind of desire lines. So from a structural perspective, as you're writing characters, they need to have desire lines. They need to have things that they want to give the story propulsion and momentum, right? Like they need it's, and what I would like about this is that the conflicts that arise between characters are not solely about like shitty personality traits or like, or alternatively forces that are much bigger than any one individual that makes people destined to be enemies. There is a combination of these big structural factors, like how does Rome manage its frontiers? What is the role of an individual king in providing for his people, right? Like there are dynamics that this show has built into the fabric of its world that are driving conflict between characters in ways that I find really compelling.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think that's a good summing up. So what I'm going to do, just because I feel like we have discussed the intellectual backdrop and the substance, but we've actually not really got into what actually happens in the episode.
Yeah, what the fuck happens in this episode?
It's so correct what Milo said, is that we have somehow managed to create three entirely separate and discrete podcasts out of one. So God knows what's going to happen when we are recording together again. I'm excited to find out. It's going to be a real brightly colored oil slick of a situation. And in fact, we're going to be all record, like next time it's all three of us, we're going to be recording together in person,
which we've never done before. I'm so excited.
Okay, so we have something occurs at the start of this episode which makes me think that something which I've been complaining about quite consistently is deliberate, which is that Ari is going to pretend to Varys that he has killed Folkwyn and he is bringing him his head. Mm-hmm. And so he just clatters the head off just some guy and takes it off to see Varys. And Folkwyn like gets really offended and is like, but that's not me. He's like, that doesn't look anything like me. And Ari says, look, to Varys, like, you all look the same. Like, he's not gonna. And I have been complaining, like I said, consistently that quite a lot of these actors look really similar and they're really difficult to tell apart.
Yeah.
So if that's deliberate, fuck you guys. That's really annoying. That's a really annoying thing for you to have done deliberately. But so this is when we find out that Varys is going to install him as the Reek. And he says, it's quite heartbreaking, this line. She said, He said, you know, this is what you've been raised for. And he said, I thought you raised me to be your son. So we don't know whether or not at this point, whether or not Varys is going to have Father Christmas, the Reek, killed. There's lots of wolf chat. Lots of the wolf will come. The wolf is on his way. Who's the wolf? Is the wolf Folkwyn? Is the wolf a literal wolf? Is the wolf the wolf of Rome, the wolf that nourished the twins, etc. The wolf will come and the world will burn. And while this is like a kind of, you know, this is some fun post Game of Thrones type chat. That's what this is. Like, if you've got this kind of chat in a show, it's because Game of Thrones exists.
We love some portentous overtones.
We love some slightly kind of like hysterical kind of portentous stuff. I mean, what I think is quite interesting is that like actually the wolf did come. As we know, these are historical events. The wolf did come, but the world didn't really burn. There was a sort of symbolic nose bloodying. You got kind of like bitten by the wolf. You had like, it nipped you. It's quite a tame wolf, really. It shows up, kind of bounds over the horizon. And you're like, God, you know what? It's what's weird about wolves is they really are big.
Yeah,
they're just very, much very bigger than creatures. You think they're going to be. And then it likes it and it goes like, ooh, and then bites you on the foot. I actually saw it.
Well, but it's such a fun metaphor for empire because you don't know what an empire is going to do, right? Like the empire shows up. You don't know whether they're just going to kind of fuck around and plant a flag and then go back home and claim victory, or they're going to kill everyone. You know, both of those are on the table. Those are both options. Like, you don't know when the wolf pack arrives. Are they hungry? Are they just going to, like, take the smallest bison from the herd? Or are they going to try and drive you all over a cliff? You don't know.
You don't know. And I am actively discouraging from myself from saying, inside the empire, there are two wolves. Because that's super annoying. And so I didn't say it. So the Reek understands that in order to preserve his tribe, he needs to do himself in. So he goes and like walks into the swamp in the Deadlands. There's a lot of people plunging swords into the ground in this episode. It's like it's one of those things. It looks pretty cool. I'm not really sure what it's meant to suggest semiotically. I think for Father Christmas the Reek, I think that it's meant to be, you don't take your weapons into the Deadlands. This is a symbol that he's laying down his arms.
Yeah, it's a symbol of worldly power. And as he passes into the underworld or into the next world, whatever that happens to be, you don't take your sword with you for that.
Yeah, exactly. And presumably there's a kind of idea that you're not allowed to take the sword like across the kind of like across the river. That's like,
Is accurate for burial rituals across the Rhine at this point in time, is that they were not doing weapons burials. They were doing cremations.
Yeah.
So this one of the reasons we actually don't know all that much about how Germanic society beyond the Rhine worked is because we don't have a great burial record. We have settlement archaeology. So we have like the villages, towns, farmsteads that people lived in. We have a pretty good idea of what domestic life looked like. But if you don't have burials, what a burial is the moment when social relations and social relationships are crystallized and given material form. And that we not having a strong sense for what that looks like beyond the Rhine in this whole region for like a pretty long period of time, like cremation is the dominant burial rite for quite a while there. And it kind of oscillates back and forth between inhumation and cremation over the next 4 or 5 centuries. But in times and places where all we have is cremation, we don't actually know that much about these things. Our impression is that by and large, while there were elites within Germanic speaking society, it was relatively egalitarian in comparison to the Roman world, but we don't know for sure. That's again, one of the things I find interesting about this show is that they've taken a situation about which we don't have that much evidence. We know far less about what the world looked like in the Germanic speaking lands than we do in the Roman Empire. Miles less, like orders of magnitude less. But they've created a pretty plausible, not essentialist, not noble savage portrait of Germanic life that I find really compelling. I find really interesting. I think they did a good job.
Yeah, it is super interesting. Like, obviously, like we have like situations where the reliance on burial as a kind of as pretty much like the only information that you have can give you completely the wrong information.
Oh, 100%.
For centuries, people thought of proper kind of like ancient Egypt as not just being the desert land, but also being like obsessed with death, because you've got these you know, these socking great tombs everywhere in the desert. But as was sort of became much more kind of apparently the case when people actually were thinking about it, rather than like understanding Egypt through this like really fun kind of like Roman theme park lens, was that they kept the death well away from them, out in the desert where they don't have to look at it, which is very, very different. That's a very, very different way of conceptualizing this. And I mean, like with this show, I think there's some noble savage stuff going on. I think we've got a little bit of noble savage stuff going on, because like all the barbarians, they are pretty noble unless we get the odd barbarian who's just like a kind of absolutely like kind of 10 out of 10 no good rat bitch. We've got like
Baldy McBeard guy.
So we've got Baldy McBeard guy. He sucks. He's terrible. We've got Thisnelda's horrible dad and her horrible mum.
They're both
just like absolutely like ghastly. And then everybody else is like, you know what? I'm super, super chill. And I think that they're more interested in some, shall we say, some slightly more nuanced character studies with the Romans than they are with the barbarians. And I know that Thisnelda herself is she's a real woman. She's our minister's wife. This is real. This happened. And I am finding the, for want of a better word, the Pippi Longstocking stuff a little bit grating.
Yeah, I can just see like that.
A little bit grating, because yes, it may well be the case that that this was a significantly more egalitarian society than Rome. However, presumably they had not determined a way of it not being primarily the women who were, shall we say, biologically hamstrung by their risk of but not just like the risk of pregnancy, but the fact that they are the ones that they're the ones having children, and there was presumably very, very little methodology in terms of how they could manage their fertility. If you are the person who is as a class who can get pregnant and have children, of course this is not the case for all women, but just for the purposes of this discussion, for the purposes of the women that are in this show, I just can't quite believe in this slightly romanticized, fully egalitarian way of structuring things, because what it comes down to, and this is what we sort of have some stuff which kind of nods to it, and then it kind of glances off because it's a bit uncomfortable, and it kind of undermines
when she gets when she's tied up, and her father's going to give her to that horrible little bit,
for example. And also the fact that the women in this show, even if it's not stated explicitly, their bodies are the site of the continuation of the tribe's fortunes.
Yes.
And pregnancy and childbirth, then as now, very, very dangerous. A lot of these women and a lot of their babies would have died, partly because of sanitation, partly because pregnancy and birth is extremely dangerous. And I think pretending that there was a mechanism by which you could have this kind of egalitarian society, kind of sort of free of the strictures of Roman imperialism, without really getting into the fact that the reason that Thisnilda is like a valuable bride is her potential for having children. And this is not just how she is conceptualized as a civic and political subject and actor, but this is her material embodied reality. And it would have been the immaterial embodied reality for presumably all of the women and girls in the tribe, apart from the trans women about whom we know nothing. Yeah. about whom we know even less than Thisnilda and co.
So I'm glad you brought this up, because one of the things that you're pointing to, there was a lot in what you said. I want to just focus on one aspect of it. It is really, really difficult to do an accurate rendition of ancient gender relations in a TV series, because there you have to balance two things simultaneously: the individual agency of the person, the agency of the character, because you need a character to be doing stuff, right? Like for them to be a meaningful character, they have to do stuff. So your character has to have agency. But whenever we're talking about ancient gender relations and the position of women in past societies, their agency is constrained in structural ways, right? There's stuff that women are not allowed to do, are not expected to do, are discouraged from doing, in ways that really impinge their agency. So how do you deal with the realities of that impingement, right? Of the very real restrictions that women in any past society or today are facing, while still allowing the character to have agency such that they play a meaningful role in the story? Like, it is really difficult to do that well. And I think that the kind of discomfort that you're pointing to is the natural consequence of how they've tried to get around this fundamental issue.
Yeah, like, you're totally right. And I totally accept what you're saying. And I think that what it comes down to with this kind of show is that you can't really have them saying like, oh, here comes Thisnilda. She's a seer. She's respected by the tribe. She's going to put some paint on and she's going to put her hair up in a tight pony. And it's going to be super cool. She's going to do some Mad Max Fury Road, like yelling warrior woman stuff. Oh no, psych, just kidding. Life for her sucked because she was a woman and therefore it sucked for her. And in fact, you know what? We're not even going to give her any lines. We fooled you. You thought she was going to do the face paint ponytail. She's not going to do any of that because she was a woman and her life was probably pretty fucking appalling. Yeah, and we can't just have like every male character being like, I don't have to listen to you, you're a woman.
Yeah, and like, because you're absolutely right to point to the material basis of that reality, which is that if, let's say she's 25 years old, ballpark it, right?
Yeah.
If there had been 10 girls born in her village within a couple of years of her, 2/3 of them would be dead by 25. Yeah. Half of them never made it out of childhood. A couple of them died over the course of their first pregnancies and childbirths in their late teens and early 20s. So of the 10 girls that she knew when she was 5 years old, 6 of them are already dead. 7 of them are already dead by that point. Like and this is a really core thing when we want to understand, why is there just a supply of dudes that you can send out to go raid and fight? It's because they are quite literally excess men. Who are never going to have potential to find a partner in that society. They're never going to have children unless they do something to raise their social status to the point where they have a chance of reproducing. Like that sounds fucked up, and it is, but in mechanical terms, that's a lot of the dynamic that's happening
That's the situation. Yeah.
Especially when you have what amounts to a polygamy for elite men. So there is not equal so for men within this tribe, there's not equal access to reproductive opportunities. Like, you've got to kind of fight for your chance to have someone, and that's also why like wife stealing is a thing, right? Like in a purely demographic sense, like if you're a dude who thinks he's supposed to have kids, like, well, you're gonna have to do something to make that happen, you know? Like, no, the Rik is not going to provide you with your state issued girlfriend.
Yeah. And like, just because we don't have any formal documentation which suggests that women and children were seen to be property, really, really no different from, because I know you and Milo talked a lot about how your understanding of violence in a slave owning society operates. I think we could expand that into how your understanding of violence in a society where women and children are.
Most ancient societies,
objectified property, which is most of them.
Yeah. And honestly, while it's difficult to establish that on the basis of textual evidence, for the most part, if you have a large enough archaeological sample of human remains and you separate out adult women, a great many of them are going to have evidence of what looks like domestic violence. They're going to have
it's a fair guess. And like, and I fully understand the thinking behind being like, yeah, but we actually don't know. So maybe, but also probably not, lads, probably not. But anyway, as it happens, Thisnilda is, she's a seer. Like everyone thinks she is rad. I do like the plunging the swords into the ground. I think it looks sick. Yeah,
it's pretty fucking cool.
So Felquin and Thisnilda, are they about to go off to persuade Mr. Bald Rik?
After he has already tried to kill them.
After he's already tried to kill them and has betrayed them and has said that he wasn't even like, I betrayed you, but I did it for the good of my tribe. He's like, yeah, I did
money.
That. You know what? I did it for the money and I'll do it again. And he tries to do it again. They try to get him on side, but it ends up in a row. Something to do with, he calls them like Thor worshippers or something. Mm-hmm. And so Folkwin kills him. I've got a note here which says that Folkwin does not look write as an ancient person. And then I've got here, he looks like he's seen Dragon Ball Z.
yeah, that's that. God, that tracks really well. That's an excellent description. It's the hair that makes it look like he's seen Dragon Ball Z.
Dragon Ball Z.
He looks like he saw Goku and he was like, yeah, that's give me the Goku.
You know what? That's what I'm taking to the hairdresser next time I go. Yeah, I want to look like Goku.
Slightly Super Saiyan vibes over there.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I do think it's interesting that the tribes appear to have different gods. I would like that to be explored in some more detail. But anyway, so Folquin kills him, and Thesnilda does something gross and spooky with the heart. She, like, cuts his heart out, and she, like, kind of waves it around. I think this might happen in the next episode, because autoplay did for me, so I'm not going to mention this just in case it actually happens in the next episode. Segestes, Thesnilda's fuckhead dad, puts himself forward as Zerik, and he's like, I'm like the obvious choice. I'm the biggest rat bitch around. Mm. And I'm pretty sure Varys sees me as a personal friend. You know, he speaks to me directly, and he says that I'm his favorite rat bitch. I'm his little birthday rat bitch boy.
Who's the puericulus now?
Who's the puericulus now? Exactly. Also, the rivalry has shown up and said, look, you said I could marry your daughter. And so Segestus, like, ties this Nelda up and tries to hand her over. It's a bit like, oh, God, oh, no, okay, no, she's the main character, so that's fine. They're not.
She does have plot armor, which makes
it. She has some plot armor, so, like, if something really grisly happens to her, at least we're probably not going to have to look at it, so that's something. So then Arie, like, shows up and is like, I'm going to see off this rival Reek, and I have, and also I am now the Reek, sorry, because I am Father Christmas's son. Brother Christmas, and therefore just, I am.
And just look at his cloak. How much nicer is that cloak?
Exactly.
It's can't compete with a cloak like that.
Look at my cloak, and like, because like Segestus is like literally just like he's just like kind of wrapped in just like this kind of in this sort of like Hessian. He's like kind of wrapped in a kind of supermarket bag for life, and he's just there being like, I can be the Reek, and Arya's like, no, you don't even have a nice soft. Look.
There's no fur in there.
You don't even have a sweet shoulder clasp. Look at you in your little costume, which is just, you know, a pillowcase with a hole cut out of it. I don't know what a pillowcase is, but that's what that looks like.
It's one of
you
the things
I know how to drape.
It's one of the things I really like about this show. I love the costume design because again, largely based on what we know archaeologically, seems to be pretty accurate. And I love that they've made them colorful, because way too often the ancient world looks like gray and drab, and it shouldn't. Like the largest economic activity outside basic subsistence that most of these people would have been engaged in would have been sheep raising and cattle raising. So they would have had a lot of wool. They would have known a lot about spinning and weaving. They would have made a lot of cloth. That would have been a primary trade good, medium of exchange. They presumably had taste in what they liked in cloth and in designs on cloth. Like, it's not like they were just like, oh yeah, just give me all the fucking give me the drabbest wool you have. Like, no, they were going to dye the cloth. They were going to do different colors of thread. They were highly skilled at this. And I like that when we look at these people, we can see like, oh yeah, they like nice clothes.
They were fabric guys.
Yeah.
They were doing the pinchy thummy forefinger. They were doing that. Oh,
everybody in the ancient world was like that. Like these, we don't think about it all that often because it doesn't survive archaeologically. But like, just like today, the most commonly produced good that's going to be making its way through society from one person to another, from a producer to a consumer, is going to be cloth. It's going to be cloth goods. It's and we don't see it because it doesn't survive. And when we do see it, it's usually like flat, two-dimensional, uncolored. But like, this was a vibrant world full of people wearing different clothes, sending messages with their clothing. I'm glad you mentioned Arminius's cloak, because that is exactly the kind of thing that an ancient person would have read as, ah, this is an important person. He's got fur. He's got, oh, look, he's blending aspects of different cultures through his costume. There's Roman military stuff in there with the belt and the sword. There's the kind of Germanic cloth pattern. There's the fur cloak. Like, it's all there for us to read him in that light. And I like that. I like the way they've done that. There's a subtlety to it.
There is a subtlety to it. And if we had time, I would talk at great length about Julius Caesar and his fondness for fabric. Because talk about a fabric guy.
Big time,
like,
fabric guy.
Caesar, he's a big sensory fabric guy. He's a cutting the labels out because it itches his skin fabric guy. Caesar is a menswear guy.
God, he is a menswear guy.
He's got a lot of feelings about how you have your jacket cut.
I bet he looked fucking good.
I bet he looked slick. Good. I bet he looks sharp. I bet he's dressed up sweet and sharp, because you know when you're a jet.
I have one Caesar follow up, but then we've taken up a lot of time, so we can conclude. But my one Caesar follow up is, when we think about Caesar, we think about like a dictator, like kind of the first emperor, like guy who did all sorts of like highfalutin political stuff. There's also a parallel Caesar who really existed, the actual person of Caesar, who loved his fabrics, loved to fuck, big time sex guy, Caesar. Mm-hmm. Like, and in fact, one of the few examples of like popular poetry that we have that has come down to us, not out of an elite milieu, not like fancy aristocrats writing poetry, of like poetry that common people did, is a marching song from Caesar's soldiers talking about how when Caesar's coming, lock up your wives because he's going to want to get down. Like,
he's going to want to get down. And also, he's going to start talking to them about his fabric.
Yeah, this is,
that's what he wants to talk about. He the reason that Caesar's out promenading is because he's got a new coat, and like everybody else, they don't like it when they've got a new coat. Like, they're embarrassed to wear their new coat out in case you get a bit of like, ah, new coat, because that's because all Romans are British school children, and they know that the worst thing that anyone can say to you is new coat, or maybe haircut. New coat. Oh my God. You've got to destroy your new coat on the way into school just in case someone yells new coat at you. But Caesar does not care. Caesar is proud to have his new coat.
So whenever you're thinking about the ancient world and you're thinking of one of these like overpowering important figures of the past, just remember, could have been a coat and sex guy. Like, yeah, at heart, like, think about how much more relatable Caesar is to us as a modern person when you just think, oh yeah, that dude loved nice clothes, loved sex, and just happened to be a conqueror of worlds and destroyer of a republic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Ari goes off to see Fulquhyn and is like, yeah, let's like unite all the tribes. No one's done it before, because as has been amply demonstrated, all the tribes hate each other, but let's unite them under this common cause. Let's catalog of ships these bitches. Let's turn this into a special interest list, if you like. Germanic Forest Super Pack. If we want to save the baseball field, all the leagues have got to work together. We can deal with Varus's legions. We can see them off. Fulquhyn, not unreasonably, it's like, why on earth should we trust you? First of all, that's not going to work. The tribes all hate each other. Second, you're a Roman. We don't trust you. Third, you're Varys' son and second in command. We don't trust you. Fourth, we've just been very, very publicly betrayed and nearly got publicly betrayed twice.
It took a human heart. It took a fucking human heart.
Like,
for us to not get betrayed twice.
I'm not feeling in such a trusting mood, Ari, so why should I trust you? And he's like, no, because I've thought of a way. I've thought of a way that I can unite the tribes. Okay, go ahead. And it is under Thisnelda. And what I think, I don't mind it. I think this is fine. And it's because she's a seer. And also because, like, she's like the daughter of a lord or whatever. But, like, she's the daughter of, as we have discussed, ad nauseam, she's the daughter of the rat bitch. So yeah. I don't see why anyone else is like going to be like, oh, she suggests his daughter. That's cool. It's more like, oh, she suggests. Oh, that's a bad trip, man.
Is she also a rat fuck?
Is she also a rat fuck? Exactly. But anyway, so apparently, we're just going to undermine every single thing we've learned about Thisnelda's family up until this point, and assume that she is not just wildly popular and known. Throughout, despite the fact she was about to be kind of like handed over like a kind of borrowed piece of Tupperware, like, oh shit, oh no, I didn't give you back your Tupperware. She was about to be handed over by her dad to a kind of neighboring so how much incredible admiration and respect she is gonna be commanding. I think that the baldy guy tribesmen, I think they're probably a bit scared of her because they watched her cut out a heart and then kind of squeeze it and go, oh, the wolf is coming. But probably because they think she's like, oh my God, why did you do that? That's insane. So they might be a bit scared of her because they think she's either a seer or just like, you know, a bit something the matter with her. But there's no real evidence that the tribes would have any interest in her beyond like, oh, what? Rat bitch's daughter. But anyway, we are to understand that she is beloved amongst the tribes, even though she was going to be handed over by like Tupperware.
Let's be honest for one quick second. One of the reasons she's beloved is because she's very attractive. And I think they could just be like, she's pretty hot. And you'd get, speaking as a man of a certain age or who has been a certain age, I know that would be enough to get a lot of folks on board.
I mean, yeah, like, why didn't I, like, it'd be interesting, like, I mean, like, obviously, like, they're not, like, presumably familiar with the, like, the kind of educational background of, like, your average Roman, like, they're not going to be like, ah, could we not just kind of Trojan cycle this one? Could we not, she's Helen, so we follow her, she's Helen. They're not gonna do that. But they could say like, oh, she's like the kind of personification of like one of our goddesses. They could have gone down that. But they don't. They pretend that she is like beloved, respected, and admired across the tribes. No evidence of this, fine, whatever. And then Folkman says, well, then they'll never follow a woman, so we kind of go back to reality. And Arya says, okay, well, this is how we do it. So I'll bring my Roman tactical mind and my military know-how, and then I'll marry her, and then people will trust me because I'm married to her who is beloved among the tribes and who is the seer. And then we have a kind of fun cutaway ending where Fotwin is just like, nah, and just swings for him,
straight up slugs him,
just got a real sucker punch. And that's the end of the episode.
I do enjoy that ending. Because like Folkvin, I really enjoy him as a character, like as compelling as Ari is, and as well as they've drawn him and as well as they've portrayed these conflicted loyalties. And honestly, I think I'm interested in how they've done Thusnelta. Like, yeah, like all of your objections, 100%, I'm on board. But I think they've drawn her as a pretty interesting character. Folkvin's just a dude. He's just out there. He's just out there doing dude things. He's a dude's rock character. And
he's a dude's rock character.
I'm here for that.
Yeah, I like Folkvin. I'm a little bit concerned because I've seen a lot of these types of shows. And every single signifier for something bad's about to happen to this guy.
Yeah.
It's all over, Folkwin. If he survives this series, then I am not good at reading the portents. You can sack me as a Haruspex because, you know.
We'll have to send you to Etruria for a remedial course in Haruspicy.
Yeah, for a remedial course in TV Haruspicy. But I think on that bombshell, I think that's the end of the episode. Thank you very much for listening. Hey, we have a Patreon. Every other episode is on there. It's $5 a month. And you also get access to our Discord, where you can address us directly with your, you know, with your tributes, observations, pictures of your cats and dogs, things of that nature. Next week is going to be Milo and Pat, going to be just the boys.
We'll try to keep it less unhinged than our last outing, which I was very happy about, but it was pretty unhinged.
Fine, it's fine.
Thank you for that seal of approval, Phoebe. All right, guys, we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.